Audible.com, home to over 60,000 audiobooks and more. Details on how to download an audiobook, including the Thalia Book Club and selected short series, are at audible.com/symphonyspace.
From PRI, Public Radio International.
He had almost reached the corner when a car turned in. It raced along smoothly, slowed as it passed him. He had an instant's warning in the split-second glitter of steel from the seat. At his side, a row of ash cans flanked the dark space of an area. He dropped to the ground, rolled over, heard the ting of bullets, sharp and vicious, as they hit the metal cans. He turned quickly in the narrow space, fired twice.
You're listening to James Naughton reading from Thomas Walsh's story, Double Check, which we'll hear on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Look out! Mayhem! The first of this program's two stories includes murder, blackmail, kidnapping, screeching sirens, screaming tall blondes, and nitroglycerin explosions. If you're guessing it's a film noir crime fiction, your suspicions are right, copper, because the story, Double Check, by mystery writer Thomas Walsh, is from Black Mask Magazine's anthology, The Hard-Boiled Omnibus. Our reader, James Naughton, has often starred on Broadway as a tough guy, notably in the musical Chicago. He's a sweetheart in real life, but he likes to act like a rough customer. James Naughton reads Thomas Walsh's Double Check.
Devine was a small, slender man, thin-featured and quick of manner. His hair and the wisp of mustache on his upper lip were deep black. His sharp eyes, wrinkled at the corners, watched the man across from him with a mixture of anxiety and forced lightness as he spoke. "You must understand that I'm not taking it seriously," he said. Flaherty nodded. He knew the type. Money, position, pride, and a manner that told nothing whatsoever of the man himself. The banker's low voice went on more rapidly. "I received the first letter 2 weeks ago. After that, they kept coming at intervals of 2 or 3 days. Of course, I paid them no attention. Men in my profession are constantly getting letters of this type. Cranks, most of them. But yesterday they put in a phone call here to my office. It was then that I decided to send for the police. Professional advice, you know." He smiled faintly with an uncertain upward curl of the lips. Flaherty nodded. "The right thing to do," he said. "Have you got the letters?" Devine turned slightly in his chair, pressing one of the white disked buzzers at his side. "Why, no, unless Barrett, my secretary, kept them. I didn't imagine." A tall man with gray eyes, gray clothes, grayish-brown hair came noiselessly through the door. He stared coldly at Flaherty after a brief nod. "No," he answered when Devine repeated the question. "Sorry, I threw them in the wastepaper basket. In fact, it seemed the best place for that kind of rubbish. I had no idea they were necessary." Flaherty's lean young face soured. Snobby guy, he thought. "You should have saved them. Sometimes there's a lot to be got out of stuff like that. Hold any more." He turned back to Devine. "What did the phone call say?" "It came in about noon. When I picked up the receiver, there seemed to be two voices at the other end, but they were speaking too far away from the instrument for me to make out the words. Oh, yes, I think I got one. Something like Ginger or Jigger. I took it for one of the men's names. When I said hello, a voice replied, 'We're not fooling. Have the money by noon Thursday. No police. If you're ready to pay, put an ad in the Morning Herald to Charlie. We'll let you know what to do with it.' Then they hung up." "That all?" Flaherty asked shortly. At the banker's nod, he rose and gripped his hat. "Don't do anything until you hear from me. I'll phone you tonight. We might have to put that ad in the morning paper to get them. There's nothing to worry about." Devine's thin features broke in a smile he couldn't quite control. His tongue tipped out nervously for an instant. "I'm not afraid, of course. I have no intention of paying. They can't frighten me like they would a little shopkeeper. I'll leave it in your hands, Mr. Flaherty. Flaherty didn't like the stuff much as he went out. He slammed the door behind him and passed through the outer offices of the First Commercial Bank to the shaded crispness of a late September afternoon. His dark, small eyes flickered right and left along the street. Nothing too stuff like that, usually. Still, he handed in his report at headquarters and was going down the stairs from the chief's office when he met Mike Martin coming up. Mike was big and paunchy, with a gruff voice and hands like fleshed mallets. Beside the younger, slimly muscled Flaherty, he resembled a fat pug next to a whippet. Flaherty grabbed his arm and drew him into a niche by the elevator shaft. "Just the man, Mike. You're working with me on an extortion case. Old man say so." "The old man's getting smart," said Mike. "He must have wanted someone with brains on the job." "Yeah," said Flaherty, "and he thought you'd pick up a little experience." "It's Conrad Devine, head of the commercial bank." Mike took a cigarette from Flaherty's pack and puffed slowly. "Devine," he said. "They're not picking smart. There's talk the commercial's about to crash." Flaherty grunted. "What bank ain't?" he said. "They called him up yesterday. He says he heard one of the names. It sounded like Jigger to him." Mike spat thoughtfully into the corner of the wall. "Jigger? Oh, that might be Jigger Burns. Been pretty quiet for a month now. Quite a while. But he don't figure in a case like this." Flaherty said, "That's the way I got it. This ain't the Jigger's line, but anything'll do these days." "Let's see," said Mike. "Jigger's a PETA man, expert on nitro. He's cracked enough jackboxes to blow us to hell." He stared at Flaherty, wide-eyed, without seeing him. "I saw him in Joe's place Monday night, 14 minutes to 8. He was wearing a blue suit, white spats, yellow gloves." Mike stopped admiringly. "Yellow gloves. The old lady bought me some last Christmas, but I'm damned if I could ever wear them. I had to tell her that they were lost. He was talking to Johnny Greco." "You're fading," said Flaherty. "I didn't hear you mention his tie. What do you got on Johnny Greco?" "Tough," said Mike, spitting again. 35, 5 feet 8, 160 on the hoof. Dark hair and eyes, scar on right eyebrow, up twice for assault, once for homicide. Acquitted, no witnesses. He can it," said Flaherty. "I know the Ginny. Davis brought him in on a loft job last week, but I had to drop him on a writ. He plays around with a Polack girl at the Esplanade. We can stop there this evening and pick him up." Mike looked at his watch. "Make it 9, he said. "The old lady's having company, and she wants me around for a bit." "Run along," said Flaherty, bitterly. "They ought to put married coppers on desk duty with aprons and bibs. I'll bet you look sweet with a baby blue dish towel spread on that belly of yours. What do you use to make your wash so white, Mr. Martin?" "Honest to God," Mike scowled. "Someday, Flaherty, I'm going to lay you like a rug." The long vertical sign threw a rush of dirty yellow light across the pavement. The letter winked on and off rapidly. Esplanade, dancing, 25 cents. 2 dusty, fly-spattered doors gave into a hallway with shabbily carpeted stairs leading up. A quick rush of music, undertoned by voices and sudden whirled-away gusts of laughter, swept against his ears as Flaherty stepped in, holding the door back for Mike Martin. Flaherty was neat and slender in a brown suit and wine-colored tie. Behind him, Mike was in gray, unpressed and shiny. His tie was crooked and his soft collar folded up in clumsy flaps. Flaherty gritted his teeth. "You're the type, fella. Watch the girls fighting for you when we get upstairs. By Christ, a blind man miles off could tell you were a copper." "They could," said Mike. "The old man might have wanted a cop on this job as well as a gigolo. If I'd had my good suit back from the tailor's." "Yeah," said Flaherty. I'll work inside. Stick by the door, Mike, and try to hide behind a cuspidor. Come on." Mike followed slowly up behind his partner's quick legs. At the stairhead, Flaherty tossed a quarter to a girl in a window and was passed through the turnstile by a tall, pimply-faced man with glasses. A small anteroom, lit dimly by wall clusters of frosted red bulbs and furnished with stuffed lounges and wood-backed settees, opened before him. Past this, the larger space of the ballroom spread from side to side of the building. Flaherty pushed his way slowly along the side, looking over the crowd. He came back to the door, went around a second time, a third. After he smoked a cigarette and danced once with a plump brunette, he walked out to where Mike was waiting in a chair near the door. "No luck," he said. "Johnny and the Jigger aren't showing. Maybe they'll be in later. We better stick." Mike nodded. Time passed slowly. Now and again, men came up the stairs and pushed through the turnstile, greeting the pimply-faced guardian as they passed. Flaherty grew restless, lit one cigarette from another, took a few quick puffs and quenched them in the sand bowl at his feet. They'd been waiting almost an hour when a little sallow-faced man came up the stairs and went past them to the men's room. Mike jerked his head. "Joey Helton, Flaherty. We can give him a try." Flaherty nodded and followed him across the room to the door. Inside, the little man was washing his hands at the sink. He didn't turn as they entered, but jumped quickly when Mike said, "Hello, Joey." The sharp rat's eyes flickered from one to the other, narrowed and beady. Flaherty said, smiling thinly, "Hello, Joey. We got some news for Johnny the Greek. Seen him lately?" "I ain't," said the little man. "What's the news?" "He's been left a dirty pair of socks," said Flaherty. "We want to see him about washing them up. Try to remember, Joey." The little man snarled suddenly. "To hell with you!" He stepped by them with a quick twist of his body for the door. Flaherty's arm yanked him back, thrust the small body against the sink. "Easy, Joey. 3 months without a sniff would soften you up." Joey glanced at Mike's stony face, licked his lips weakly. He said, "All right. I don't know nothing about the Greek. He's been coming here pretty often and hanging out with that Polish girl. That's all I see." "That's all I want," said Flaherty. "You're a good boy, Joey. When you go out, step up to that Polack and say something. But nothing about this. You got it?" "Yeah, yeah," said Joey. He straightened his tie sullenly and he went out. A second later, they followed. Flaherty reached the edge of the dance floor a yard behind the little man. He watched him thread away through the crowd, stop before a tall blonde girl near the front. She nodded, turned away, and Joey went on again. Flaherty went back to Mike. "I'm going to call Devine," he said. "Stick here." "Okay," said Mike. "I'll wait." Flaherty went past the ticket taker to a phone booth at one side. He thumbed through the book, got his number, dropped a nickel in the box. When he announced himself, a man's voice said, "Just a moment, sir." He was trying to get a cigarette from his pack with one hand when a quick staccato voice broke metallically in the earpiece. "Mr. Flaherty?" Flaherty grinned a little. There was no "eh" stuff this time. Devine's voice quivered and ran up swiftly like a child's. "I got another message by phone. They threatened to kill me tonight. They found out about you. You must get out here at once. If they..." Flaherty got out his cigarette and scraped a match against the side of the booth. He said, "Don't get excited. We'll have some men out there in 10 minutes, maybe less. They're trying to scare you into it. Don't worry." He hung up, scared as hell now, huh? But tough enough this afternoon when the steam wasn't on. No guts that kind. Mike was waiting for him. "Want to hop out to Devine's?" Flaherty said. "Pick up a man on your way? He's got the jitters, thinks that they're going to spot him tonight. I'll stick here. Maybe I can get something from the Greek's girl. Call me when you get there." Mike said, "Okay," and went out towards the stairs. Flaherty stepped onto the dance floor and looked about. The girl Joey Helton had spoken to was off on one side in a row of chairs reserved for hostesses. Flaherty walked across the floor and stopped before her. "Dancing this one?" he asked. She nodded, looked up without interest. When the music started, they glided out to the floor. She was as tall, almost, as Flaherty, with blonde, short-clipped hair and a heavy, sensuous mouth. Her eyes were dark blue, thick-lidded. They danced on without speaking. When the number was over, Flaherty said, "Thanks, you can step, sweetheart. Have the next." She responded with a faint shrug of her bared shoulders. The lights dimmed down, and a young man in the band laid aside his instrument, began to croon in a sleepy voice through a small megaphone. She had a firm, supple, curved body. She kept her head turned, eyes over his shoulder. He shifted, tightened his hold. "You're nice," he said. "Me, I think so. Too nice to waste your time on greaseballs." She didn't say anything for a moment. Then she spoke from the side of her mouth, not turning her head. "Greaseballs?" she said. "Sure," said Flaherty. "You know who I mean. That little Ginny I saw you dancing with last night." Her face swung up to his, whiffing with it a cheap reek of perfume across his nostrils. There was a faint mocking gleam under her mascaraed lashes. "I was not here last night." Her voice was low, husky, with a thin blur of accent. Flaherty laughed. "Must have been the night before. I see you with him a lot. Steady?" She shrugged, humming the song the band played deep in her throat. "I get breaks like that," Flaherty said. "Any chance of ditching him for dinner tonight?" "No," she said. I got the sick mother. Ah, I know the song, Flaherty answered. The old man ain't so well, and you're keeping a kid's sister in a convent. All right, girlie. I'll see you again. When the music was over, he let her go back to her seat. She was meeting someone, probably. He'd have to take a chance on that being Johnny Greco. He resigned himself to wait, looking at his watch. 10:20. Mike's call would be due now. He walked out to the ante room and smoked a cigarette. When the phone in the booth tinkled, he went across and into it before the pimply-faced man could turn. Hello, he said. Flaherty? Under Mike Martin's furred voice pulsed a ripple of excitement. Better get out here quick, boy. Someone laid a pineapple in Devine's car. The chauffeur and him was blown to hell not 5 minutes ago. Flaherty got a taxi at the corner and stared, tense-eyed, into the darkness during the 10-minute ride. What was coming off? Johnny Greco was no fool. Neither was Jigger Burns. Bumping a guy was a dough job. They weren't in it for fun. Devine hadn't come through. They didn't give him time. Force of example, so that the next heavy man that they touched wouldn't squawk? That maybe. He wondered what Mike had seen. The cab swung into the quiet darkness of Magnolia Avenue. 3 blocks farther on, a knot of people huddled together under the pale glint of a street lamp. Lights gleamed from houses all about. Hastily clad people grouped in doorways called to each other in shrill tones from window to window. Flaherty got out and paid the driver. Wait 10 minutes, he said. Devine's house was set back from the road on a low terrace. Flaherty saw it as a large 3-story building with a curve of graveled driveway leading whitely up across the dark lawn. A thick hedge banked it on the street side. When Flaherty cut in through this on the driveway, a uniformed figure stepped out before him. He was fishing for his badge when Mike Martin came out from the shadows. All right, Smith, he said. Get the crowd away. It's up here, Flaherty. They went up in silence to the top of the hill. Lights poured from the ground floor windows, sending a flood of illumination across grass and shrubbery. Ragged curtain ends fluttered out through the smashed panes. The stoop to the porch sagged drunkenly, half of it toppled on its side and resting on the earth. The porch itself had been a colonial affair, tall, white, with slim pillars and a curved portico. 3 of the pillars were snapped off in the center, and at the right end, a segment of roof hung down like a misshapen curtain. The car squatted before the house, a foot away from the stoop. In the light, it was a twisted and charred mass of grayish metal. The top was blown off, and fragments of glass from its windows littered the ground with silver shreds of light. At the side nearest Flaherty, the metal warped outward in a great hole. It's a morgue job, said Mike. You couldn't identify either of them with a microscope. Flaherty bent and looked inside. When he straightened, his face was grayish. Cripes, he said. Yeah, said Mike. Messy, huh? Did you see it go up? Mike spat and nodded. We just got here, he said. I grabbed Smith at the station and we came out in the flivver. I didn't see anybody in the street. I told Smith to wait and crossed over. Then I saw a little guy in a top hat come down a stoop and get into the car. Flaherty scowled at his feet. Devine, he said. I thought the damn fool would know enough to stick inside. I heard the starter begin to purr just for a second. Then I felt the pineapple bust loose. I didn't see nothing. It slammed me back through the bushes like I was a laundry bag. When I got up here, it was all over. Flaherty lit a cigarette and tossed the match in the grass. For a second, the flame scooped his lean, sharp face out of the shadow. They might have had it wired to the motor, but then why the hell didn't it blast out coming from the garage? What was the chauffeur doing? Did he leave the bus at all after bringing it out? I don't know, Mike answered. I haven't had time to talk to the servants. They're so scared they're blubbering. They got an English butler in there you should see, Flaherty. God, he'll give the laundry a job this week. See what the chauffeur was doing, Flaherty said. You might get a tip question the people around here. I'm going to go back for Johnny Greco and the Jigger. This is where the nitro came in, Mike. Blocks distant, a siren screamed. Flaherty tossed his cigarette. That's probably the old man. Devine was a big shot in this burg. He'll want to know how come. I'll leave you get the congrats, Mike. So long. I'll phone you at headquarters later. Mike cursed bitterly. You, yella. The old man'll save some for you, Flaherty. I'll see to that. At the corner, Flaherty's taxi swerved to avoid the police car, then straightened out along Magnolia Avenue. They made good time. It was 10 minutes past 11 by Flaherty's watch when they pulled up before the Esplanade. The crowd inside was thicker, gayer, noisier. Flaherty sifted through the mob, passed to the anteroom, came back to the dance floor. The blonde was nowhere in sight. He went out to the gate. To the pimply-faced man on duty, he said, "Where'd the tall blonde go, that Polak girl?" The man shrugged. "She left 10 minutes ago. Flaherty cursed. "Where'd she live?" he snapped. "I'm not running that kind of place," Pimply Face said. Behind the lenses, his eyes were small and guarded. "There's plenty of blondes in there, guy." Flaherty yanked him around. He said, hard-eyed, "Where does she live?" Pimply Face licked his lips uncertainly and then shot out his jaw. "What are you looking for, guy? Trouble? I told you." "Yeah," said Flaherty. "I heard you the first time. I guess you ain't got the records. You're in a spot, fella. You know the regulations on joints like this?" Pimply Face tried to hold his stare and failed. He said sullenly, sure, I got the records. Wait a minute, I'll see." He went across to the window, spoke to the girl inside, and came back with a small white filing slip in his hand. "Anna Brinsky, 213 Allington Place," he said, raising his eyes furtively to Flaherty's. "What's the trouble? Flaherty let his words drift out without answering. He took the stairs 3 steps and turned left at the door. 4 blocks over, Allington Place emptied into the avenue, a narrow, darkly lit thoroughfare with 2 parallel rows of cheap brownstone tenements leading down. He found 213 by counting off 6 houses from the corner. The numbers over the door, faded by time and weather, were indistinguishable in the gloom. In the vestibule, he struck a match, passing the flame over the bells. He read near the end, "Anna Brinsky, apartment 43. The door swung back at his touch, admitting him to a narrow hall, palely lit. He went up on his toes, 2 steps at a time, without sound. A radio moaned harshly in one of the flats, squawked with a sudden inrush of static as he passed. He caught fragments of voices, snores, the lingering thick odor of fried fish. At the top of the flight, a single bulb glowed weakly, shedding a wan light over the apartment doors. There were 6 on each floor. The one numbered 3 was in an angle near the front. When he got to the 4th landing, Flaherty stopped and listened. He could hear nothing but the high, querulous voice of a drunken woman below. His footsteps padded on the oilcloth, slid off into the darkness with low echoes. He rapped sharply, 2 times, on the door of 43. There was no bell. After a minute of quietness, someone said inside, "Who's there?" Flaherty said hoarsely, "Anna, Johnny sent me over. He can't meet you tonight. He's been tailed." She said something short, bitterly. Flaherty grinned. When the door opened a crack, he laid his body against it and pushed. The room inside was brightly lit. There was a day bed at one end, not yet made up, a messy dressing table across from it, a tall floor lamp with a torn shade near the window. The air was drenched with the brassy smell of burnt-out cigarettes. Clothes littered the couch, poured over it onto the floor. An open suitcase lay on the small center table. "So, you're going away," said Flaherty, leaning against the door. "You should let me know, Anna." Her hair was down, stuck with curlers. She was wearing a sleazy dressing gown. She smiled softly, but her eyes kept the same. "The cheap bull," she said. "What do you think?" "No fun," said Flaherty. "I'm asking, Anna." He locked the door behind him and went across to the hall that led into the tiny kitchenette and bath. Both were empty. He grinned, coming back. "So, Joey Helton squeaked to you after all. We'll have to mark him up a point." She sat down on the couch and picked a cigarette from the heavy bronze smoking stand at the side. "What do you want?" she said. "Nothing much," said Flaherty. "Where were you going to meet Johnny Greco?" She shrugged. Her gown slipped down and she pulled it up lazily with one hand. "I don't know him, this Johnny." Flaherty's eyes narrowed. "You're wasting your time on that stuff, sister. Where were you going to meet him?" She stared down at the cigarette in her hand without answering. Flaherty turned away from her and walked over to the suitcase. He thumbed through the flap in the top. He picked up the garments one by one, felt them through, dropped them to the floor. Her eyes changed color, darkened in the cone of light from the lamp. She spat something that Flaherty couldn't understand. He stared at her for a second. "Don't say it in English," he said. "I'm the kind of guy that hasn't got any chivalry." When the bag was empty, he went over to the couch and reached down for the pocketbook that she'd tried to hide with her back. As he bent for it, she was on him like a tigress, without warning. He snapped his elbow up under her chin, felt the jarring click of teeth coming together as her knee shot up viciously to his stomach, stabbing him with pain. He grabbed her wrist. His grasp tightened, twisted until she moaned suddenly and went soft in his arms. He dropped her roughly to the couch and picked up the bag. "Any more?" he asked. She lay staring up at him, her eyes blazing. After a minute, Flaherty turned his attention to the bag. Two folded pink strips of paper were on top. He shook them out, dropping his eyes along the lines. "Los Angeles," he whistled. "Getting out far, weren't you? Ooh. The other one for Johnny?" He put them in his pocket. "Get dressed, kid. I'm going to take you for a little ride downtown. I know a couple of guys there that have the knack of getting questions answered." She sat up sullenly, rubbing her wrists. He tossed her a dress from the heap and fished in his pockets for his cigarettes. He was taking them out when Knuckles rapped quickly on the door. Half into the dress, she stopped, looked up, her mouth opened. Flaherty's grasp yanked her head back in an instant. "Quiet," he said softly. "It'll be better for you later, Anna." The Knuckles rapped again. In two steps, Flaherty was by the door, swinging it back, hidden as it came. Anna stood motionless by the couch. A tall, gray-clad man entered, his head jerking forward as he saw her. He spoke quickly, without breath. "Anna, it's all set. He might have heard Flaherty breathe. In the quick twist of his head under a lowered hat brim, Flaherty could see nothing but lips and a sharp chin. He said, pushing the door to behind him, "Drop it, guy." The other snarled, his eyes wavering for an instant to Anna. "You dirty little..." Flaherty shot as the man's gun came out, dropping him limply, suddenly, like a pricked balloon. The short, sharp crash of the gun echoed back from the walls to a beating silence. Flaherty heard faintly the drunken woman still quarreling as he bent over the body. "You've killed him," said Anna. Her voice was quiet enough. She stood by the bronze stand, the cigarette in her fingers drifting smoke lazily across her face. Flaherty said nothing. He gripped the man's shoulders and swung him around back to Anna for a brief moment. At the sound of her rush behind him, he straightened. Too late. On one knee, as he brought the gun up, he saw the light glinting dully on the edge of the bronze base. Then it crashed down in a vicious arc before the dark glitter of her eyes. Flaherty fell forward across the dead man, his gun dropping from his hand, his mind whirling and lost in Red Street confusion. He was pulled back to consciousness slowly by a throbbing agony over his left ear. When he opened his eyes, the light pierced them like tiny knives driving into his skull. He pushed the body away from him, got to his knees, his feet, stood swaying unsteadily as he looked around. The lights in the room were still lit, but it was very quiet. Anna, of course, was gone. He went out to the kitchen and put his head under the faucet, letting the water pour coldly over his cheek. The skin was unbroken, but there was a lump that felt like an apple where the blow had landed. After a minute, he felt better. He dried off his face and returned to the living room, looking at his watch. 12:15. He hadn't been out long. Half an hour, maybe, not more. He gripped the dead body and swung it over on its back. He found himself looking at the thin, pale face of Barrett, the banker's secretary. There was a hole just over the bridge of his nose. Flaherty squatted on the floor, resting his body on the clenched hands. Barrett. It came clearer to him in a while. Barrett and Anna. The two of them had framed it from the start. Then where did Johnny Greco and the Jigger come in? Had Anna been using Barrett all the time, ready to ring in the other two for the big prize? He cursed his aching head. This mixed it up worse than ever. If Barrett was the brains, he wouldn't have stood for the blow-up. Not without the money. He'd be in a game like this once, maybe, for big stakes, but he wasn't the kind to risk it as a steady racket. He hadn't got the guts. Then why had Devine been killed without a chance to get the money? Flaherty couldn't figure it. Unless there was something more, something in back, something he hadn't come upon. He pushed back the dead man's coat and turned out his pockets. A wallet, dark leather, well used, a few bills, a letter, some cards, a slip of white paper without inscription marked in hasty handwriting, 1934. That was all. He put the paper in his pocket, picked up the gun, and rose. He closed the door behind him, leaving the lights still lit and the dead eyes of Barrett staring glassily at the ceiling. The hall was pretty quiet as he descended. He wondered if anyone had heard the shot, taken it for backfire if they had. It wouldn't be healthy to meddle in a joint like this. He turned left on the pavement and headed for the avenue, grateful for the cool night air that swept over his forehead. He had almost reached the corner when a car turned in. It raced along smoothly, slowed as it passed him. He had an instant's warning in the split-second glitter of steel from the seat. At his side, a row of ash cans flanked the dark space of an area. He dropped to the ground, rolled over, heard the ting of bullets, sharp and vicious, as they hit the metal cans. He turned quickly in the narrow space, fired twice. The car flashed under the lamps like a black monster, spitting four more stabs of orange from its sides before it rounded the corner at the far end and roared away. Windows slammed up, and a man's voice shouted hoarsely. Flaherty rose from his shelter, brushing his pants carefully. He was getting hot now. They'd come back for him, sure enough. If he'd been out 5 minutes longer, there'd be two stiffs up there now instead of one. Why? What was coming off so important that they had to get him out of the way? It was Anna, of course. She was the only one who knew where he was. She had told Johnny, and he came back to finish the job. The game wasn't over yet then. And whatever was going to happen, they were afraid he would spoil it. They thought that somehow, somewhere, he'd gotten a tip. What the hell could it be? It worried Flaherty. Did they take him for a sucker, potting at him like that? What was under his double-blanked eyes that he couldn't see? Farther down the avenue, there was an all-night drugstore. Flaherty went in and called headquarters. After a minute, he was connected with Mike Martin. He said, "Meet me at the corner of Lynch and Holland as soon as you can make it. Things are popping, Mike." Outside again, he waited in the dark entrance of a jewelry store. Lynch Street, a thoroughfare of office buildings and stockbrokers' firms, stretched dark and silent before him, its blackness interspersed by scattered yellow pools from street lamps. The black bulk of Devine's bank squatted back from the pavement a half block away. Flaherty lit a cigarette and scowled at it. Things had moved fast in 10 hours. Now, a dull, monstrous boom, a roll of thunder in a confined space, crashed in one wave down the avenue. A golden flare burst up and expired in an instant behind the glass doors of the commercial bank. Flaherty raced up the street, bringing his gun loose. A block away, he heard the shrill pipe of a police whistle, and closer at hand, the rasping squeal of car brakes. He swung around to see Mike Martin hop off a taxi running board and rush to him across the sidewalk. "Take the front," snapped Flaherty. "Don't go in. They've not had time to scatter." He raced around the side of the building over the grass plot that rimmed it. A door gaped open in the rear with the red bulb of a nightlight on top. In its glow, Flaherty saw that the yard, rimmed by a high stone fence in back, was empty. They had to get out the front way then, or around by the grass plot, and they couldn't have yet. They were bottled. He got inside, keeping to the shadows. A heavy puff of smoke was rising slowly from the center of the building's long room. As he advanced cautiously, it thinned, faded slowly against the high stone ceiling. Between the bookkeeper's desks in back and the glass-partitioned cashier's cages in front, there was a wide iron-gated alcove. The gate was open now, with the sprawled figure of a man before it. Flaherty was motionless in the shadow, listening. He could hear nothing. Queer, this. They must have known the explosion would be heard, must have known. After an irresolute moment, he stepped over the dead man and into the lighted alcove, automatic ready before him. The huge steel door of the vault was flung outward against the wall, the center of it torn and twisted like paper by the charge. Flaherty gave it a glance and then went back to the watchman, rolling him over. An old, wizened face, not much expression now, a bullet hole through the back of his head. Flaherty got up and went softly to the back door. Mike stood in the shadows outside, dropping his raised arm when he saw Flaherty. The man on the beat came up. "I left him at the front. You see anything, Flaherty?" Flaherty took a second before answering. "The watchman's stiff, Mike. He's been dead at least an hour, and the vault's been cleaned of cash." "Hell," said Mike. "They couldn't have cleaned it. They didn't have time." "No," said Flaherty. "They didn't have time, Mike. That's the funny part." After a second, he continued. "We haven't figured this thing right from the start. There's something in the back of this that we're not even sniffing. It don't hang together the way it is. If they wanted to rob the bank, what did they kill Devine for? He wasn't in the way. I don't get you, said Mike. It's open and shut to me. They bump off Devine, but they don't get the money. All right, they figured they're in, and they might as well get something out of it, so they land back here and blow the vault. Jigger's open one's a lot tougher than this cheese box. Flaherty said, that's one way, Mike, but why did they clean the vault first and then blow it? That's the only answer. We both know they didn't have time after the charge went off. A guy would do that just for one reason, to make it look. He stopped. After a breath, he said, oh, softly, and whistled. Mike moved restlessly. What the hell are you getting at? I was just wondering, said Flaherty, how tall Jigger Burns is. He's a little guy, not much over 5'5". Flaherty grunted. It's beginning to fit. From his upper vest pocket, he took a small slip of paper and held it out to Mike. After a minute, Mike handed it back. 1934? Don't mean nothing to me. Flaherty rapped out briefly the events of the night. When he had finished, Mike said, the secretary, huh? I'll be double damned. We ain't got much time. What do you think that number means? Mike pushed his hat back. Street number, you think? Yeah, said Flaherty. Only there ain't a street name on it. It might be a post office box, only there ain't no key. Maybe it's next year. Mike stirred uneasily. Lay off, he said. Someday, honest to God, I'm going to lay you like a rug. Flaherty said, I found it on Barrett's body. Now, what's he carrying it around for? Because it's something important, something he mustn't forget. Now, take it that way. Then he's got to meet someone there tonight. They haven't much time, at 1934. It wouldn't be a street number. He'd know the house and wouldn't have to mark the number down on paper. You can't run out and hire a house in the middle of the night. Besides, the getaway has to be fast, so it would be something that they could hire any time and leave when they wanted. What's left? Hotel room. I was going to say that, Mike answered. If it's a hotel, there's only two in town high enough for a number like that, the Sherman and the Beresford. Flaherty crushed the slip in his pocket. There'll be a squad car along any minute. You stay till they slow, Mike. Let them go through the place. They won't find anything. Then hop over to the Sherman. That's the nearest and the busiest. The clerk will know if I'm upstairs. And if I'm not, try the Beresford. He left Mike and walked swiftly to the corner after a word to the policeman in front. Three blocks up and two over, he entered the lobby of the Hotel Sherman. From the restaurant in back, swift, syncopated strains of dance music floated out. But the lobby itself was almost deserted. The clerk at the desk was a slight, superior-looking person with a pale face and exquisite hands. When Flaherty flashed the badge, his lower lip dropped. He said, Oh, really? I hope... Flaherty fumbled for the paper. You have 19 floors, haven't you? The clerk looked relieved. No, he said there are only 18. Of course, Flaherty stopped searching. He cursed and chewed his lip while the little man eyed him apprehensively. How tall's the Beresford? He snapped. 16, I believe. I know that we're the biggest in town. 800 rooms. Flaherty got out the paper and looked again. No mistake. 1934. That settled that. Telephone number. Safe deposit vault, maybe. But how... The clerk cleared his throat nervously.
It's funny, he said. You know, I don't know whether you... You see, we have to be careful. There's so many superstitious people. We haven't a floor numbered 13. We skipped that one. 13 is 14, and so on. We really have only 18 floors, though our room numbers run up to 19. Now, if you...
Flaherty turned away. Whirled back. Who's in 1934? Get it, quick. I want the key. The clerk jumped at his voice. He came back from the inner office holding a key, his eyes worried.
A gentleman registered this evening for that room, Mr. Walker. Is there anything wrong? I can't let you have this key without our man.
Flaherty reached over and grabbed the key. Who's your house dick? Gilmore? Send him up as soon as you locate him. Tell him to be careful. It won't be a picnic. There'll be shooting. He headed across the lobby while the clerk said, oh, faintly. At the top floor, Flaherty left the elevator and stepped into a long, red-carpeted corridor, empty and brightly lit. He looked at the room numbers and swung to his left. 1934 was near the end of the hall. He stood outside, listening. No sound. He fitted the key in the lock and twisted the knob an inch at a time. Softly. A tiny line of blackness appeared at the crack, and Flaherty bent double, slipped through in a flash, silently. Darkness netted him in, diffused faintly by two windows at the far side. He made out the dim white splotch of a bed to his right. Nothing more in the light blurred focus of his gaze. Nothing happened. He stood motionless an instant, surprised and uneasy, before turning to the wall for the light switch. The faintest flicker of darkness moved from his left. In the same instant, he felt a thin rush of air, and something hard, sharp-edged, crashed viciously into his wrist, knocking his gun to the floor. He dropped, feeling for it, as the lights overhead snapped on. A woman's leg flicked past his hand, kicking the revolver across the rug. Someone said in a soft, oily voice, "Hold it, Flaherty." Flaherty got up slowly to his knees, his lips pressed tight against the pain in his wrist. There were three people in the room. Anna, behind him and to his left. Johnny the Greek, near the door, automatic in hand, and a slender, small man in a chair, bound to it and gagged. Johnny's face, edged with a bluish bristle of beard, twisted in a leer.
"Smart guy, Flaherty. Too bad we was expecting you. Next time you're in a lobby, look around. There's telephones."
"I should have thought of a lookout," said Flaherty. "But this don't help you, Johnny. I got the joint tied up in a knot. The outside's lousy with cops."
Johnny sneered. "Says you. That stuff don't go, Dick. You came into the lobby alone. Your pals will be along, but that'll be too late to do you any good. We're about through here."
His eyes flickered to Anna.
"Behind him, kid." To Flaherty, he said, "Get over to that chair. Snappy."
Flaherty went over slowly and sat down, watching his face. There wasn't a chance. Johnny stared at him through narrow lids, his eyes small and hard like balls of black glass. Killer's eyes.
"I'll have to get some towels," Anna said. "They'll do for his arms."
She moved back of him toward the bathroom. The little man made sounds under his gag. Flaherty looked at him and saw a large head with blonde, oddly streaked hair, pale eyes, clean-shaven upper lip.
"What do you want?" snarled Johnny.
The sounds continued. He dropped one hand and loosened the gag.
"Spit it quick, fella."
The little man breathed hoarsely once or twice before speaking. He looked at Flaherty and quickly away. His words were rapid, imploring.
"You've got the money. Give me a chance to get free. I'll leave you downstairs. If he knows who I am..."
"I know you're Conrad Devine," said Flaherty.
He was stalling for time.
"Where the hell were Gilmore and Mike Martin? If he could just keep them here 5 minutes. You shaved off your mustache and you blondined your hair. Not a very good job, but good enough to fool anybody who thought you were dead. And who wouldn't?"
The little man snarled savagely. He said to Johnny,
"You see?"
"Sure," said Flaherty. "Your bank was on the rocks and you didn't have a nickel to save it. You thought you'd get what you could, so you framed this little racket with Barrett. The fact that you two birds got where you did in a bank is a laugh."
Barrett knew Anna through going to the dance hall, and she got you in with Jigger Burns. You let Jigger in on it for a cut. You needed him for the bombs. You figured everything was as safe as Gibraltar. When I phoned tonight, you made out you were scared, asked me to come right out. You cooked up some story for Jigger Burns. You were about the same size, and you sent him out to your car when you saw the police flivver arrive. Fitted in one of your top hats. I was supposed to recognize your figure. I'd be too far away to see the face, watch you blown to hell, and give you a perfect alibi. Even the cops wouldn't be dumb enough to suspect a dead man. You mentioned Jigger to me at your office, so I'd be looking for him. That made everything hotsy-totsy. You'd be living in another town with enough dough to last you the rest of your life. The police would be looking for a guy that was in 1,000 bits, and I'd be left holding the bag.
Yeah. Johnny said, "That ain't such a bad idea, Flaherty. I like to see cops holding the bag. We'll give you a start, Devine, but no breaks, guy. Let them loose, Anna."
There was a sudden quick flicker in Devine's eyes, instantly hid. Flaherty, seeing it, said nothing. Anna came over in a moment with the towels and knelt behind Flaherty, pressing his arms together. Flaherty continued to talk while Devine stretched himself with a long sigh and went over to the bed, watched carefully by Johnny.
"I got the lead at your bank," Flaherty droned on. "The vault was blown after the money was taken. Why? To make it look like a strong-arm job. Whoever pulled it got in the back door with a key, murdered the watchman, and opened the vault with the combination. Then they set the time bomb and beat it. I got to thinking about you then, Devine. You had the keys and you knew the combinations. There was talk your bank was cracking. The body in the car couldn't be identified. You didn't have any notes to show me. You were too smart to rib them yourself."
"Shut up," snarled Johnny. "Got him fast, Anna?"
Flaherty laughed. "And at the end, they gypped you at that. When you got the dough and came back here to lie low for a couple of days before heading out,
The girlfriend and Johnny fixed you like a baby and take away the candy. Hell. The banker's pale eyes were slits of ice. His lips were frozen in a wrenched smile. You're very clever, he said. Anna yanked the toweling tight. As she began to fasten the knot, Flaherty flexed his arms, pushing her backward to the floor. Johnny came forward a step, not watching Devine, his eyes vicious. Once more and I drop you, guy. Flaherty got it then, watching the set, pinched-in face of Devine as his hand dropped to his overcoat pocket. Johnny had frisked him. Had he frisked the top coat on the bed? The damn fool. Flaherty got his weight on his toes, ready to leap. Yeah, said Johnny. Be a good boy. You ought... Anna screamed suddenly, seeing the sudden bulge in the banker's pocket. Johnny, he... Johnny whirled, opening his mouth. The shot came before he could speak. He gave a puffy, choked grunt, fell flatly to the floor. At the report, Flaherty flung himself face down behind the bed. Johnny was on the other side, moaning, his gun a foot away from his clenched hand. Flaherty wriggled forward, stretched his arm, grabbed the butt as darkness fell at a click over the room. There was a rush of feet in the hall and confused shouts. Someone lunged furiously at the door. Flaherty heard Mike Martin's bull voice roaring. Devine fired twice. The bullets dug splinters from the floor, flung them in Flaherty's face. Flaherty didn't shoot. He crouched back, watching the far wall. In the darkness, Anna kept screaming, shrilly, terribly. There was a rustle of motion, a scraping, a sudden rush, before the pale square of the window on the far side was darkened by a slender figure. Flaherty could see it very clearly. He fired once. The door to the hall crashed back, and a slit of light melted instantly into the greater brilliance of the ceiling bulbs. Mike was by the switch, covering the room. In the doorway stood Gilmore, the house detective, his fat face pale and flabby. What the hell? He said. Flaherty got to his feet. It's all right, he said. The party's over, fella. In the center of the room, Anna was on her knees over Johnny, sobbing. The Greek didn't seem badly hurt. He sat up and stripped off his bloody coat, cursing sullenly under Gilmore's revolver. On the other side, a breeze from the open window puffed the curtains lightly past the figure of Devine that lay half across the sill. It didn't move. Flaherty went over and lifted it back from the fire escape, then reached out and pulled in the yellow leather bag Devine had pushed before him. Under two shirts on top, crisp piles of greenbacks were stacked row on row to the bottom. Flaherty grunted, caressed them a second with his long fingers. What a haul, he said, and I'd have to be a copper. Mike Martin's puffy red face showed over his shoulder. What's all a shooting, Flaherty? Who the hell is that? Ain't you heard, said Flaherty. It's Santa Claus. Mike cursed. Honest to God, Flaherty, he said, someday I'm gonna have to lay you like a rug.
Thomas Walsh's story, Double Check, was read for us by James Norton. After a brief pause, we'll hear a very funny piece about alarms by the humorist Dave Barry. You're listening to selected shorts recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide. From PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. If our first story was about organized crime, or at least disorganized attempts by professional criminals who can't always shoot straight, our second story is about amateur efforts to deter burglary. The story is called False Alarm. The writer is the Florida-based newspaper columnist and popular humorist Dave Barry, and the reader is Larry Keith.
The man was standing right outside our master bathroom. He couldn't see Beth and me standing in the hallway, but we could see him clearly. His face was covered with a stocking mask, which distorted his features hideously. He was dressed all in black, and he had a black plastic bag stuck in his back pocket. He was using a screwdriver to open our sliding glass door. I always wonder what you're going to do in a situation like this. Run, fight, wet your pants. I am not experienced with physical violence. The last fight I had was in eighth grade when I took on John Sniffin after school because he let the air out of my bike tires. Actually, I didn't know that he did this, but he was the kind of kid who would have. And all the other suspects were a lot larger than I. The man outside our house was also larger than I am. He jerked the screwdriver sideways and opened the door. Just like that, he was inside our house, maybe 6 feet from where Beth and I were standing. And then he saw us. For a moment, nobody spoke. "Cut!" yelled the director. "Way to go, Ozzy," I said to the stocking mask man. "Looking good, looking criminal." "I'm wondering if his bag is too dark to show up," said Beth. "Everybody wants to be a director." Well, anyway, as you have guessed, Ozzy wasn't a real burglar. He was part of a production crew that was using our house to shoot a promotional video for the company that installed our burglar alarm. It's here in South Florida, it's standard procedure to have burglar alarms in your house, your car, your workplace, and if you've had expensive dental work, your mouth. Now, I like having an alarm in our house because it gives me the security that comes from knowing that trained security personnel will respond instantly whenever I trigger a false alarm. I do this every day at 6 a.m. when I get up to let out our large main dog, Ernest, and our small emergency backup dog, Zippy. I'm always in a big hurry because Zippy, being about the size of a hairy lima bean, although less intelligent, has a very fast digestive cycle, and I need to get him outside right away. So I fall out of bed, barely conscious, stagger to the back door where the both dogs are waiting, and I open the door and weep, 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 weep. I realize I have failed to disarm the alarm system. Now I have a problem. Because within seconds, the voice of a trained security person is going to come out of the alarm control panel asking me to identify myself, and unless I give her the secret password, she is going to cheerfully notify the police. So I stagger quickly over to the panel, but this leaves Ernest and Zippy alone out on the patio. Theoretically, they can get from the patio to the backyard all by themselves. They used to be prevented from doing this by a screen enclosure around the patio, but thanks to Hurricane Andrew, most of this enclosure is now orbiting the Earth. The hurricane did not blow away the screen door, however. It's still standing there. And the dogs firmly believe they firmly believe that it's the only way out. So, I swear I'm not making this up. Instead of going 2 feet to the left or to the right, where there's nothing to prevent them from simply wandering out into the yard, they trot directly to the door, stop, and then they turn around and look at me with a look that says, "Well, go outside," I yell at them as I lunge toward the alarm control panel. "There's no screen anymore, you morons!" I beg your pardon, says the cheerful alarm lady. Because this is not the secret password.
Burke,
says Ernest, who is trotting back toward the house in case I'm telling her it's time to eat. Grunt, says Zippy, as his internal digestive timer reaches zero and he detonates on the patio. We do this almost every morning. We're very dependable. In fact, if some morning I didn't trigger a false alarm, I think the cheerful alarm lady would notify the police. You'd better check the Barry residence, she'd say. Apparently something has happened to Mr. Barry, or else he's strangling one of his dogs. So the alarm people have been very nice to us, which is why we let them use our house for the video. It had a great action ending, wherein Ozzy runs out our front door, and an armed security man drives up, screeches to a halt, leaps out, puts his hand on his gun, and yells, "Freeze!" This is Ozzy's cue to freeze and look concerned inside his stocking. They shot this scene several times, so there was a lot of commotion in our yard. But fortunately, in South Florida, we're used to seeing people sprint around with guns and stocking masks, so the activity in our yard did not alarm our neighbors. Oh, look, Walter, the Barrys planted a new shrub. Really? Where? Over there, next to the burglar. Anyway, the point is, our house is well protected. Now, the alarm system is there in case we ever need it, which I doubt we ever will. Because thanks to Zippy, only a fool would try to cross our patio on foot.
False Alarm by Dave Barry was read for us by Larry Keith. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our theme music is Roger Kellaway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2009 by Alice Siebold. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International. You can learn more about Selected Shorts in all its live and recorded incarnations at our website, selectedshorts.org.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Hi, I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Greetings to our Selected Shorts podcast audience. If you've always wanted to be a selector of shorts yourself, here's your chance. On June 9th, 2010, Selected Shorts at Symphony Space in New York will feature published stories selected by you, our audience nationwide. Go to selectedshorts.org/favorite to submit your story suggestions. Then, in the spring, you'll vote for your favorite of the final contenders.